Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app. Todd Feinberg, now 2 till 6 on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Hello, hello. It's Monday. Todd with you, WTIC. We talked once in a while with a guy named Jeffrey Tucker. Maybe you remember him. Really a high-level thinker. Smart guy. He's an economist, and he's an opinion writer. He writes for Real Clear Markets, and he caught my attention with his most recent column, which is addressing the public unrest, the pushback against the oppressive regime in Cuba. His column is called, "Will Cuba's Needless Lockdowns Finally Topple Its Sick Regime?" So Jeffrey Tucker's thesis is that COVID is the cause of the unrest that might finally do the trick and put an end to the hateful regime in Cuba. Jeffrey Tucker, thanks for being here. Good to have you back. Jeffrey Tucker, thanks for being with us again on WTIC.
You know I love being here.
And we love having you. It's fun reading your columns. You wrote one a couple days ago on Cuba, and you mentioned needless lockdowns as if somehow COVID is responsible for the trouble going on in Cuba right now. Is that the case?
I just couldn't believe it that in all the coverage that nobody mentioned the lockdowns. But this is me for the last year and a half. Why aren't people talking about the real problem? You know, the Cuba case is absolutely bizarre because, you know, when I saw the riots breaking out, when I saw, you know, the protests on the street, when I saw all the turmoil, the initial headlines in the mainstream press were, "Oh, everybody wants a COVID vaccine." You know, it's like, can we get any more fake than that fake news? I mean, that was just so transparently. Like, I'm so fed up with these amateur reporters and their bogus, you know, adherence to, you know, whatever the latest line of the day is. You know,
wait a sec. The amateur reporters, you're talking about the American media?
Yeah. I mean, these punks, you know, that all they care about is like, what are they supposed to say? And so no matter what they're covering, they always cover, you know, I'm surprised that, I'm surprised it wasn't caused by climate change, but actually I'm almost certain you could find some stories out there that say the protests in Cuba are due to climate change. You know,
I mean, you're saying that you just caught my attention with that statement that that reporters today are so unsophisticated that they copy each other's language so that they aren't embarrassed by saying the wrong thing. Because I was kind of struck by how the Democrats decided the pushback on the accusations about critical race theory was going to be, oh, critical race theory isn't even what they're saying it is. It's something that was created in universities in the 1940s. Then I started seeing that repeated all over the place, like they were being sent something they were supposed to clip and paste in order to write stories.
You have to understand the career of a journalist and how the trajectory works and the path towards progress. So everybody starts out as the crime reporter at their local newspaper and eventually wants to be the national political reporter for the New York Times. I mean, there's a huge difference between those two things. It's a long travels, but the only way that you can guarantee that you can get from one point to the other in a smooth trajectory is to comply with the prevailing line at the time, which is typically that which is being advanced by the party in power, you know, the real source of influence and power out there. And so the key thing about journalists is that you can never make a mistake. They know this. They're extremely risk averse. So they want to stay safe. They want to stay safe, and they want to keep the paycheck flowing, and they want to get that next job, a regional newspaper, a national newspaper, and so on. So this is how they structure everything, which means that they spend all their time trying to figure out what they're supposed to say. And no matter what they're reporting on, they try to find out what that vital,
where the margins are.
Vital truth is, yep. So that they'll continue to advance and avoid making a huge error, you know? And especially these days, since everybody's all over the news media, they're super risk averse. They don't want to do anything wrong. So, you know, no reporter is going to come out and say, you know, on his or her own, you know, the chaos in Cuba is a result of 100% stringencies and coronavirus lockdowns, even though that's clearly what it was, or that the lockdowns don't work, because they clearly don't, but nobody could say that, because they're going to get in trouble. You know, they don't want to attract attention. What they want to do is be read, you know, to do their jobs, you know, turn in their, 1,200 word article, and for it to, you know, cause the eyes to glaze over, and then just move on to the next step. They don't want to become controversial, much less say something that's different from what other people are saying, unless you're an opinion columnist. But even that's very scary. If you're writing for the New York Times, you know for sure what you can say and what you can't say. And people will do anything to keep their jobs, Todd.
Yes, of course.
It's amazing. I've had friends of mine, and some papers are better than others. The New York Times is the absolute worst. But friends of mine who, because I do a lot of editorial consulting, they get a call from the New York Times and, at noon, and they're saying, like, by 5 o'clock, we want you and I to write an article on the following topic. And so that's when I get the call. You know, it's like, well, can we, is this doable? Yeah, sure. So bang out 1,200 words, and then the author of the article is like, well, this is pretty good. Let me tweak it here. And then they turn it in. So now it's 3 o'clock. And the New York Times comes back and says, oh, look, there's breaking news. The old lead is not very compelling. We need a new lead to cover the new breaking news. And the author's like, well, okay. And so then that's the first two paragraphs. And then it's like, listen, this, the seventh paragraph here, our fact checkers have flagged it. Like, they're not actually sure that that's right. So we're just going to delete that and delete that and delete that. Also, on these first two paragraphs that we wrote, we could use a little more elaboration on that and tie it up here at the end. Anyway, so on this goes. Now it's 4:30 and now it's 4:47. They've got a 5 o'clock. So they send you the final edits at 4:58, and the article is nothing like what you submitted. In fact, it's mostly entirely been written by the New York Times editors themselves. And you're like, just go.
And the editors were doing this with full knowledge at the beginning, that they were reshaping the story, and the writer of the story becomes the victim of the process.
Oh, yeah, that's what they do. And they love to keep their jobs, the editors do. So the more they muck with your prose, the more they justify their jobs. And so you just end up being a symbol. You're just a name out there. And people go along with it because, why do they do it? Why do they go along with it? Because they want an article in the New York Times. Full stop. That's it. That's why.
Well,
they go along
The way you lay it out, you're getting to deadline, and you want to get your paycheck and move on to the next project, right?
Yeah, and it's not even the paycheck. In this case, it's just the fame and prestige of having an op-ed in the New York Times. So you've got 2 minutes left, during which time you could say, you know what? I don't recognize this article anymore, and I'm just not going to be the author of it. Goodbye. All right, you do that. You guarantee you will never be called again.
And you're blacklisted.
You will never be called again, and you've just given up a chance for fame and credibility and fortune and so on. So, you know, it's pretty interesting, because I've been at the thick of this process probably half a dozen times and seen people's willingness to just, you could call it selling your soul. It really is. It's just people's desire to get in print in a prestige place overrides all their concerns for truth and credibility.
But also what you're describing is a process that where there is a hidden hand. We don't know what the agenda of the hidden hand is. Is it ideological? Is it business? Is it familial? We don't know what is driving.
There's always something different, right? But there's a reason why they tap such and such writer. They know he's a malleable personality who has a name in a certain field, you know, whether it's virology or religion.
And is predictable in terms of what his attitude towards things will be.
Yeah. Yeah. That he's not going to be posting weird stuff on Twitter or Facebook and discredit the New York Times. So suddenly you just recraft your entire life to be as conventional and respectable as everybody else. And next thing you know, you're just, your name is just a series of letters, you know, and it's not really reflecting your views. You know, sometimes I've had friends of mine be appalled by op-eds in the New York Times. They're like, can you believe this guy who knows better is saying the following thing? You know, I look at that and go, well, he probably didn't want to say that.
Yeah.
But it was a choice between saying that and not appearing. He chose to appear. And that's what that's it's.
So a couple of years ago, was it two summers ago now, when Barry Weiss was the opinion page editor of the New York Times, and she got she got thrown out because she allowed a United States senator who was a Republican to publish an opinion piece. She decided to publish an opinion piece written by a U.S. senator, and that created such outrage amongst other writers of the New York Times that they managed, that it created an uprising against her. Why did she not understand these dynamics that you're talking about?
So I may be wrong about this, but I don't think it was Barry Weiss. I think she was an opinion columnist, got thrown out on her own. That was the editor that was hired after the 2016 election to bring some balance and fairness to
I'm sorry if I got that wrong.
No, that's all right. I don't remember the guy's name, but yeah, you're right, though, on every other check, he was thrown out because he ran that article.
Hang on, Jeffrey. You just realized we have to take a break. We're talking with Jeffrey Tucker, Real Clear Markets, and we were going to talk about Cuba, but as so often happens, we've drifted off course. And when we continue, we'll clarify further and continue with the conversation about the New York Times and the media in general, because I think this is valuable stuff. I'm Todd Feinberg. Yes, he's Jeffrey Tucker. Stay with us on WTIC.
Something from the Todd Feinberg Show? Listen to the podcast on WTIC.com/podcast.
It's Todd Feinberg continuing now with Jeffrey Tucker talking about what's happened to the media. Jeffrey is a daily writer for Real Clear Markets. What has happened to the media? How has it become an agent of wokeness? And finish telling us the story about the New York Times and what happened there over the past couple of years, Jeffrey.
Well, so in that case, it was pretty interesting because after 2016, so the New York Times has become woke just in the last like three.
So they were scrambling to come to an equilibrium internally with their wokeness.
They were. So what happened was that after Trump won the election in 2016, there was a moment there at the New York Times. They're like, we had no idea that he could possibly win this election. There wasn't a single person in our newsroom or in our social circles who had the slightest inkling that Trump had any chance whatsoever.
They were victimized by their own uniformity of opinion.
Yeah, and there was a weird moment that happened. I think it was December, you know, after the election, where the New York Times sent out a special note to all of its subscribers saying, "Listen, the election results shock us as much as you, and that's an indication of, you know, our need to be a little more scrupulous. We've got new methods of polling now, and we're going to broaden out our base." There was a real sense that the New York Times needs to some extent, it's fine if it's left to center, but it needs to at least be something of a snapshot. So you don't want to be completely blindsided by reality. You know,
you don't want to shroud your own perceptions to what the reality is that you're supposed to be reporting on. You're supposed to be reporting.
Right. And so there was this brief moment. I think it lasted about a year, but then the demographics and ideological orientation of the newspaper, you know, the woke crowd will not tolerate any kind of like fairness or both sides kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a crowd that believes, you know, wildly passionately in one truth. And so, and you would think with 150 years history or whatever New York Times has, that they could have resisted that, but no chance, because all the younger hires, everybody's out of the Ivy Leagues, they're all being taught by crazy theorists in the literature department and history, and you know, the wokeness has taken over the university. And so this is the only thing. So the New York Times completely came around, and now it's not even recognizable. I mean, compared to 10 years ago, it's not even the same newspaper. So every article in that, I used to, during 2018 and 2019, I was like, how can these writers there, you know, spend their entire day, you know, researching and writing gibberish that doesn't amount to anything? How can they be so maniacally attached to this? It must be a dreadful job to have, to be constantly having to write about the Russian conspiracy, you know, to collaborate, you know, to making Trump the president. It must be exhausting because there's no evidence for it. But actually, I don't think you're exhausted by it, because they're on a mission, you know? It's a kind of a religion, and they just feel a tremendous passion about it. And now that's the whole of the New York Times. It's to a large extent, this is spreading out to the rest of the media too.
Since the New York Times is the premier newspaper in the country, and that's really right, the other news organizations, most of which are located in New York, are like the networks, use that as the starting point for what is news today. Their shift would represent a national shift, would it not?
It does, and it's, well, when you say national, I don't think you mean societal, because it actually.
No, I meant national media, that they flavor.
National media. Yeah, it's definitely a media bubble.
Perspective on the news.
So what we've got today, Todd, is a tiny group of progressive fanatics representing, you know, less than 1% of the educated elite in this country. And they've taken over university departments, and now they're taking over the whole of media and now social media. And I think because that's their whole reality is media, universities, elite circles, and their favorite social media platforms. They think that they're confusing their takeover of all those things with their like social hegemony, which is not true. I mean, what we actually have going on is a growing isolation of this elite, progressive wokester religion / ideology, and there's a massive chasm between that and what you see actually operating in society, and I think something's got to give. I don't think this can last. I mean, you can't have, you know, a vast amount of the country, you know, furious about lockdowns, for example, and hating the guts of masks and suspicious of vaccine mandates and you know, loathing of public health officials who have been lying to us for a year and a half on one hand, and the other hand, the entire academic media, social media elite,
floating along in their own cloud.
It's not recognizing the
schism between them and the rest of us.
That's right. And this something's got to give. I mean,
isn't that what gave with Trump?
Trump represented a revolt against the elites, right? But then they participated in killing him.
Is still out there, don't you think? Don't you feel?
More intense than ever. Todd, it's more intense than ever. And it's hard to document. You certainly can't do it using polls. You know, I'm in Texas. I've been in Texas for a few months, and I talked to, you know, I'm a sort of a natural reporter in a sense. Like, I just love to talk to people about their opinions. I can't find anybody anywhere in Texas that favored the lockdowns. They all thought it was like the most ridiculous thing that ever happened. Should never have happened. It's a normal pathogen. If you get sick, go to the doctors.
But Jeffrey, I've got to interrupt. I'm sorry. We've got to wrap the segment up. I wish we had more time, but it's fascinating. And all these issues deserve more fleshing out. And certainly it's been a big help because you've given people a better understanding of the media and how it came to be as biased and adamant as it is right now. Jeffrey Tucker, Real Clear Markets, thanks so much for being here.
Todd, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, that was fascinating. Okay, we're going to get ourselves a news update and then more conversation coming at you here on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app. Todd Feinberg, now 2 till 6 on WTIC News Talk 1080.
There is so much to know. Hi, Todd here, WTIC. Aren't you amazed how much there is to know? Every day we're learning, and every day we need to learn more. Every day we learn how much we don't know. Have you ever heard about medical cost-sharing communities? There's something that I think originally had its roots in a religious exception in Obamacare. Not its roots there, because it goes back longer, but protected by Obamacare. And this thing exists where there is an alternative to health insurance, but it's not insurance. You're not allowed to call it insurance because the legal structure of it is different. Insurance has to protect you. They have to guarantee payment of your bills, whereas this thing is a cost-sharing community. It's a voluntary sharing of responsibility without legal liability. Interesting thing. And it's something we should know about. So I've invited a guy named Dr. Tony Dale to join us for a conversation, which we will do right now on WTIC. Dr. Tony Dale, thanks for being here on WTIC.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation.
So you've got an organization that's a medical cost-sharing community, which is a thing that's allowed to exist, that's not an insurance company, but does help people pay for their medical care. And I think even though it's protected under law, this alternative, it was carved into Obamacare to protect what was largely a religious-based service. Yours is not. It's called Sedera.com, S-E-D-E-R-A, Sedera.com. How is Sedera.com able to provide this service without being an insurance company and without being a religious community?
That's a great question. So let me just clarify one thing. You are absolutely correct that the religious healthcare sharing ministries were given an exemption within the Affordable Care Act. So they are exempted. We do not fall into that category.
We don't
have an exemption in law. No. Sedera was started because I had this passion that the really good work the Christian healthcare sharing communities were doing, and I've been a member of them myself and had done a lot of work for them over the years, that work needed to be expanded. And when the Affordable Care Act exempted but limited what these Christian groups could do, I began researching what would it take to bring such an approach to market where it could move into the mainstream.
And oh, so you found a loophole. I love it.
What I found was that basically in the United States, an approach to business is legal until someone says it's not, not the other way around. And that there was lots of case law showing that what the Christian healthcare sharing ministries were doing was not insurance. And we wanted to find a non-insurance approach because, you know, everybody needs access to healthcare. But whoever said that the only way of providing that is through insurance? Actually, there are lots of approaches.
Can you give us an example so we can understand this intellectual difference? Because we've been living in an insurance-only world for so long, we can't imagine what the alternative would be.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if we go back to our textbooks, I remember studying you know, in my sort of junior high or high school years about, for example, the Amish community, who, if the barn burned down, they didn't have insurance, but the community rallied together, and they had a barn raising, and they put up a barn all over again. Well, really, that's the model that the Christian Healthcare Sharing Ministries pioneered, but which actually has been enshrined in both practice and in law for a very long time as an acceptable approach. In the modern economy, we tend to call that the sharing economy. So what does that look like in relation to what we're doing? Well, Sidira members contribute monthly into their own medical cost-sharing account held at an FDIC-insured bank. Then when members of the sharing community have a medical need, funds from, you know, all the other members or as many other members as are needed to help in that context are then shared directly to the member in need so that they have a way to deal with their needs. So it's people.
But that sounds
people.
That sounds like what we think of as being insurance. Is the difference in a corporate structure or a liability, or what separates the two things?
Okay, super question. The primary difference is whether or not risk is shared. Because in a sharing community, all of us remain responsible entirely for our own individual medical bills. But we're trusting, and experience says that the trust is well placed, in the community to be willing to participate with us in our need, just like we're participating with others in their needs. So there's no transfer of risk in a medical cost-sharing community.
So in an insurance company, the insurance companies are assuming legal responsibility for some of our bills, and that's what's different? Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. The insurance contract is literally a contract in law where we give them our risk in exchange for also giving them our money.
What would happen to an insurance company if there were some crushing debt from a cluster of insured that would put them out of business? Do they have some kind of backup insurance that assures that everybody's claims get paid based on the contract?
Yes, they do. And a typical insurance company is not only pooling the money so that they can take care of needs, but in the really catastrophic sort of group situation you're describing, they have what's known as stop loss. So, you know, a big insurance company in Germany or Switzerland or here in the United States who act as a secondary backup. The sharing communities do not have that. Because if you were to put that in place, then you're guaranteeing to pay the bill. And we can never make guarantees. All we can provide people is the history of the community and of its willingness to step in and to share these costs in such a way that people are made good.
So the challenge, I guess, would be then that we as consumers want to look at your company, your cost-sharing community, and see that it's large enough that it would not be at risk of that kind of failure. Is that correct?
Well, I think that's a true statement. I'm not sure there is such a thing as large enough. There's always risk. And part of the reason that the healthcare sharing ministries or medical cost-sharing organizations like ourselves have been able to deal with bills is that obviously we do have plenty of members, but we also handle the money in a very transparent fashion, and we teach our members to be actively engaged in the process. And it's that active engagement that actually helps drive costs down in such a significant way.
Oh, okay. And this is one of the things that I think is a disaster for the mainstream insurance model, that there's something about insurance that makes us feel that it's an adversarial relationship. And there are also laws passed to support the insurance companies, I think, that forbid us from doing things like going out and shopping for the best deal on, say, an MRI. And In this model, where it is a shared enterprise, we would all be incentivized, if we're part of Sidera.com, to find the best deal to make sure our shared money is being spent wisely. Is that fair?
Absolutely. You know, when we have skin in the game in the way you've described, i.e. we care because it's my money that I'm sharing and it's going to a real person and a real person is sharing with me, We want to make sure that we're handling medical costs wisely. And Americans are brilliant consumers. Why has that been turned off when it comes to one of our largest expenses, which is healthcare?
Makes no sense.
No sense at all. And you mentioned the MRI. I mean, the difference in price between an MRI at a local hospital here in Austin, Texas, and, say, going to a free market expression such as Green Imaging, which is a cash pay only, they don't deal with insurance, is paying $350 instead of $3,500.
We're talking with Dr. Tony Dale, the founder of Sedera.com. It's a medical cost-sharing community, and I wanted everybody to understand what these alternatives are for finding a system other than insurance through which you can help pay your medical costs. Are there similar products in Sedera? That is, if I'm signing up for the community sharing, am I getting a plan that says 80% of these things will be shared and so on?
You know, it's important to understand that all of our language around what we do is deliberately entirely different from insurance, because mm-hmm. we don't want any confusion in people's minds.
Sure.
You know, being part of a voluntary association which isn't making guarantees is totally different from paying a premium and having an entity that you can sue if you feel things have gone wrong. Yes, from outside there are some similarities, but we have a completely different approach, which is based on trust and mutual respect rather than on contract and trying to enforce that in law.
Dr. Tony Dale, let us take a quick break and continue the conversation, because this is fascinating. Stay with us. More coming up on WTIC.
Miss something from the Todd Feinberg Show? Listen to the podcast on WTIC.com/podcast.
It's WTIC Todd Feinberg. We're talking with Dr. Tony Dale. Sedera.com is the name of his website and the business that goes with it, well, the enterprise that goes with it. It's a cost-sharing medical community, which is different from insurance, as Tony has been careful to point out. And I want to find out how it's different and how it's structured. Can you clarify that for us, Dr. Dale?
Yeah, I'd love to try and make it really simple. We're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing community, and this non-insurance approach is designed for helping people to manage large and unexpected healthcare costs. So what that means, if you think about it, is that all of us are choosing on a month-by-month basis to contribute money to be available to the community for the community to then allocate to any members who are in need. Now, in the vast majority of months, you know, let's say that 9 out of 10 people who are contributing, they don't have any medical need. I mean, I guess I'm a physician, but I haven't been to a doctor in who knows how long. But I'm perfectly happy to contribute, knowing that thousands and thousands of other people are doing exactly the same, and that the nonprofit community will administer those funds in a way that the people who have needs have the funds directed to them so that they can handle those needs. And because in that context, all of us are cash pay, we can go in, we can deal with cash payments. And the cash pay economy, the free market economy, dramatically lowers the overall costs of what happens.
So if I'm a member of Sedera and I'm part of this sharing community, is there anything concrete in terms of what I can expect to be paid of my bills?
Oh, absolutely. There are very clear and detailed guidelines that are right there on the website for anybody to look at. And it's very clear. We're there to help share in people's medical costs. So, yeah, if you have a medical need, we want everybody to have some skin in the game. So we have what's called mm-hmm. an initial unshareable amount that people will pay out of pocket. But then as long as the community has the resources, everything beyond that initial unshareable amount will be shared with the community. And we have paid every bill of every member over the last 6.5 years that we've been in existence. It's worked extraordinarily well.
Wow, that's amazing. Can you tell us what the entry fee is, or is that forbidden in...
Oh, no, not forbidden at all. I mean, there's no entry fee. There's a monthly share that all of us contribute. It's the same all across the country. It's only divided by age banding, dependent mm-hmm. on people's age. And people can see the numbers right there on the website.
Oh, but I thought you said there was an initial non-shareable fee that was paid.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's something that people will choose when they join the program. They can actually choose anywhere between $500, well, not anywhere, but, $500 or $1,000 or $1,500, so that they choose how much of a need that they are going to handle out of pocket. And then based on what they choose for that initial unshareable amount is how much we ask them to contribute to the community.
Got it.
Obviously, that makes sense to you?
Yeah, but finish your thought. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. So I was just going to say what perhaps is intuitively obvious to your listeners, and that is that the smaller the initial unshareable amount, okay, then the larger the amount you're going to need to contribute each month because you're only putting a little bit of skin in the game at the actual time.
And do we do this as an umbrella over existing policies? Are we obligated alternatively to give up our insurance? How does that part of it work?
Okay, again, great question. No obligation. Everything here is voluntary. The vast majority of people would use this approach instead of insurance. There's certainly no obligation to have insurance. If someone wanted to do both, they would be allowed to. We don't prohibit a person from having insurance. This is, for most people, just a sensible alternative.
How about insurance contracts? Do they forbid being involved with this kind of sharing organization?
I'm not aware of any insurance contract that would say that a person was not also welcome to be a part of a sharing organization if they wanted to. I'm just not sure I'd recommend to a person that they needed both.
Because it would be redundant based on how people are, the kind of service they're getting from Sidera, where you're saying everybody who's been a member has had 100% of their health care bills paid for through the sharing community.
Well, they've had 100% paid for every eligible need as described in our guidelines after they paid their initial insurable amount. Absolutely. Those are multiple $100,000 bills, and those are $5,000 bills.
And what sort of carve-outs? Is there anything surprising? How do those work?
I wouldn't say there's anything surprising. There are some practical things that people may not be used to in a modern sense. So, for example, if I went to my property and casualty company and said, hey, I'm sorry that my house burned down last week. Could I please have insurance so that you can pay me back for what happened last week? They're going to say mm-hmm. no. That's known as a pre-existing condition. So we, unlike the insurance companies, do not cover pre-existing conditions. And that's because pre-existing conditions are a social issue that have an economic consequence. And in America, the government has said that they will guarantee the profits of the insurance company in exchange for the insurance company's handling pre-existing things. So, that's not an economically sound approach, but it's certainly a socially appropriate approach. We don't have the ability to put our hands into other people's pockets.
Yes.
Through taxes and things, and so we can't do it that way.
All right, Dr. Tony Dale, this is fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time to introduce us to Sidera.com. It's Sedera.com. It's a medical cost-sharing community. Go to the website and investigate it and let me know how it works out for you. Tony, thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk with you.
Of course, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
So this is intriguing to me because there aren't a lot of other ways to do healthcare payments that we talk about because we've been shoved into this corner by government taking over the healthcare industry gradually through the years, where now they control more than half of the healthcare spending, which just destroys a marketplace. But you can see there's an idea here for how we can have lower cost health, quote unquote, insurance. I mean, he's not allowed to use that word because of the technical differences. But the idea is a payment system. If you've got a payment system that works and it's cheaper because people have skin in the game and they're driving down the cost, that makes you say, wow, why wouldn't the government be encouraging more of that to go on instead of the insurance model? Why are they so in love with the, well, because they're in love with everything that's bad. Because what's good is what's good for them. It's not what's good for us. That's just how they operate.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.